Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon and joining us now. It's a pleasure to welcome Nathan Bomey. He is a journalist with USA Today, and he was the lead reporter on Detroit's bankruptcy and General Motors as well for the Detroit Free Press. He is the author of a new book, Detroit Resurrected, To Bankruptcy and Back. Detroit Resurrected by Nathan Bomey. Nathan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is really, I think, a largely underreported story. It is, after all, the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. And it's a fairly complex story. There are a lot of different players. And I think because of that, a lot of people outside of Detroit, at least, probably are not terribly familiar with what happened to Detroit. Let me just turn it over to you and tell us a little bit of the narrative of how Detroit got into the condition where it eventually went into bankruptcy.
Well, no, I appreciate you having me on, and I think you're absolutely right that Detroit's story is very complex in some ways. But on the other hand, you know, everyone has an opinion for how Detroit went broke. You can sort of argue that the auto industry's collapse over several decades and globalization ultimately helped kind of hollow out the economic core of Detroit. Some people would blame the unions. Some people would say the government didn't invest enough. Others would say the school system failed. And some people would blame racial inequality. Some people would blame debt, you know, the explosion of debt that occurred in the city. And ultimately, you know, I think the answer is really all of the above. The city's, you know, financial implosion culminating in bankruptcy in 2013 can really be blamed on many, many factors. And so in this book, I attempt to, you know, kind of discuss that a little bit, but focus more on what the city did to help, you know, to get back on its feet and to make the hard decisions that they refused to make for so many years, because by the time that they got to bankruptcy, they had $18 billion in debt and only about $1 billion in annual revenue. So it was completely unsustainable.
Well, and I think sometimes we forget what a great city Detroit in its prime really was. I mean, this was an industrial center. It helped the United States win World War II. The Center for Automobiles, which is a huge part of the economy, a cultural center. You think about Motown, for example. I mean, this was really quite the place. Its decline was interesting. It was a slow decline for many years. But I think that there was, yeah, it's probably difficult to identify culprits or heroes in this story, although I think one culprit does kind of stand out, and that's Mayor Kilpatrick.
That's right. You know, Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, who left office a few years before the bankruptcy, was, you know, ultimately responsible for significant amount of corruption that occurred during his tenure. He's in prison now for almost 30 years. And, you know, his corruption was really the last straw for Detroit's image. But it didn't necessarily, the corruption itself wasn't the reason for the bankruptcy. It was his plain old-fashioned financial mistakes as a politician that ended up tipping Detroit into insolvency. And the big example I cite is that Detroit borrowed $1.5 billion to pay its pensions. And this was a real big mistake, because ultimately it was a pay-as-you-go obligation, that you could describe it as that, and they actually put it on the credit card. And so, you know, instead of making the tough decisions and realizing that Detroit was a much smaller city and could not afford the kind of benefits it had it promised, over time they just continued to make promises they couldn't keep, and eventually retirees paid the price, because Detroit's bankruptcy ended with retirees taking some cuts to their pensions and health care. And I think, you know, the argument I make is that politicians across the country should see this as a cautionary tale of the fact that they're endangering retirees or workers when they refuse to tell them the truth and say that we can't necessarily afford these types of benefits at all times, and we need to make responsible decisions to protect you and to protect the taxpayers.
That is an interesting point. Is it that nobody saw the trajectory of decline in Detroit, or saw that there were investments that weren't living up to what they were supposed to be for the retirees? What was the big problem here? Or was it just that the unions demanded more than was realistic?
I think it was a combination of both. I think, you know, that the unions and the politicians had a very close relationship over the years in Detroit and, you know, refused to realize that the city had to make significant changes. I think everyone understood that Detroit's population was not what it used to be. This is a city that was built for 2 million people, that was the Silicon Valley of its age, like you mentioned, you know, a city that helped really preserve freedom for the world in World War II by converting its plants into manufacturing facilities for defense products, you know, military planes and aircraft and weaponry that helped defeat the Nazis. And so it's amazing to see a city that was known as the arsenal of democracy to ultimately wind up in a situation in which it's hobbled and in which democracy was actually suspended temporarily in Detroit because the governor appointed an emergency manager who took over the city of Detroit, and he's the person who ultimately made the tough decisions to get Detroit back on its feet, and that meant bankruptcy.
You talk about the emergency powers, and what was particularly interesting there was, yes, it took away the democratically elected leaders of Detroit, and then voters in Michigan voted on that idea and said, that isn't what we want. We don't want emergency leadership. And then the governor went and did an end around on that vote.
Yeah, they did. They actually, when that law got appealed, the legislature and the governor, basically the Republicans in Michigan, sort of re-implemented a law, very, very similar law, to allow for the appointment of emergency managers. And this time they made it so that it was referendum proof, so it could not be overturned by voters again. And that was a controversial move in Detroit. On the other hand, the polls suggest that people supported the bankruptcy in Detroit. And so I think there was a general understanding that bankruptcy was necessary to, you know, make the decisions that had not been made for so long. And that included sacrifice not just for the retirees, but for Wall Street creditors too. You know, this was a case that dealt out the pain pretty evenly. You know, and there will still be people who will argue that one side got a better deal than the other side. But ultimately, everyone had to sacrifice to allow Detroit to get the money that it needed to start reinvesting in the city. Because, you know, Detroit had 40% of its streetlights were out when they filed for bankruptcy. The city police department was taking 30 minutes to respond to emergency calls. There were tens of thousands of abandoned properties. This was a city that needed to invest in basic services. And ultimately, by shedding about $7 billion in debt over the course of this bankruptcy, they helped free up the money that the city needed to invest in those things.
The decline of Detroit, and you chronicle some of it in the book, was really rather devastating. I mean, the murder rate soared, and I think you quoted this statistic that only 11% of the murders were solved in finding the killers?
Yes, and I really describe what happened to Detroit as a humanitarian crisis. It really was. People don't necessarily like to use that term because it's so severe, but that's what it was. And, you know, Detroit was something that people like to opine about but not really do anything about, you know, because it was a gradual collapse. This was not something that happened overnight, like you mentioned before. It was something that happened over the course of 60 years and can be blamed on many different things. And so that gradual drip that sort of occurred, the loss of population over time and the explosion of the debt over time and the spending problems and everything that you can cite was sort of just gradual and ultimately contributed to allowing a city, a great American city, to turn into this. And I think it's sad to see that nobody was willing to make the hard decisions. And that's why ultimately I think the bankruptcy was the right thing to do for Detroit, because it actually restored the social contract. In a sense, it said a city exists for one purpose, and that's to serve the people who live there, not to serve the creditors, not to serve the unions or the politicians, but to serve the people who actually pay taxes and live in the city. And that is now the new paradigm in Detroit.
Yeah, I think a few interesting things along the way to get to that point, though. And I think a couple of them are probably cited in the idea of, one, the museum, which housed some nearly priceless art. You can put a price on it. And then, so one idea there was, well, let's sell some of this art to raise money. Another was the idea of, where are they going to get the money to actually tear down the abandoned buildings in Detroit?
Right. And it's funny because I think that when people realize that the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is a world-class art museum located in the heart of the city, was possibly going to be liquidated because of this bankruptcy, I think that's when the world started paying attention. Because that's something that people can understand, that you've got a museum with a Van Goghs and Picassos and Monets that's, you know, a gem, really, of an institution that could ultimately be liquidated and, you know, hollowed out because of the financial mistakes that the city made and the decline over the years. You know, that was a really dynamic situation. You know, when this is what happens when a great American city goes broke. You know, people, creditors come looking for your assets, and that's exactly what happened to Detroit. They made a serious play to attempt to force the city to sell off all that artwork, and the emergency manager, in fact, considered it very significantly, I think very seriously. He thought about actually pursuing this until the mediator who was involved in this case, a person named Gerald Rosen, and a bunch of foundations helped raise money to offset these pension cuts that the retirees were facing and then preserve the museum. It was this grand bargain deal that ultimately helped pave the way for the city to get out of bankruptcy.
That was ultimately the idea here. There was a grand bargain that was struck through a considerable amount of compromise. How did the grand bargain come about?
Well, when Gerald Rosen, the mediator, had this idea that perhaps he could raise some money from outside foundations and from the state of Michigan, which had previously refused to give the city any money, you know, it was a very unique idea. This had never been done in bankruptcy before. No one had ever brought in outside money to help solve a case because, you know, nonprofits like the glory of investing in the future and not really fixing the mistakes of the past. And so they thought that the nonprofit foundations like the Ford Foundation and the Kresge Foundation and the Knight Foundation would not be interested in this. But it turns out that they were, because they believed in the future of the city of Detroit, and they believed that this was something that they could do to make a difference in the lives of retirees and in the cultural life of Detroit by saving the museum. And ultimately, the money came together very fast. And nonprofits are not used to moving fast, but they did here. And that's a credit to them. You know, and I think it's whether it's a pathway for other cities is probably not, because ultimately very few cities own their own art institution, and the question is, what would have happened without this? I think that we could still be in court potentially, but they realized that by linking the fate of the museum and the pensioners, then they could both end up cutting a deal. And this is an example of compromise. You know, you mentioned the word compromise, and we see so little compromise in American politics, and so to see that happen in a city that was used to political divisiveness was really dynamic and encouraging, and gives me hope that, you know, maybe there's hope in other places in America to have political compromise to make progress.
And part of that, you wrote about the Rhodes test. Explain that term.
Sure. Judge Stephen Rhodes was the bankruptcy judge in Detroit and the person credited with helping to keep the case moving fast and to drive it toward a resolution by treating everyone fair, but also tough. And I think that he, you know, it was tough love in many cases. And Judge Rhodes ultimately had to decide, was this deal fair to the creditors and to the retirees? And the question of fairness is a real matter of debate in American law when it comes to bankruptcy. What is fair to the creditors is a real matter of debate. And he said that ultimately in a municipal bankruptcy like this, where a city cannot be liquidated and must continue to exist after the case, that fairness is defined by the judge's conscience. If he believes that the retirees are being treated fairly compared to the Wall Street creditors who maybe can afford to take a bigger hit, then that's a fair way to assess, then that's an acceptable way to assess fairness.
Okay, hang on just a sec. And as we continue, we'll find out whether indeed it was a fair resolution. Detroit Resurrected, our guest today, Nathan Bomey. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're talking with Nathan Bomey. He is the author of a new book, Detroit Resurrected. And, yeah, you've heard about Detroit, but you've probably seen some pictures. Parts of the city look like, it's gone through war. We're talking about the resurrection, and it involved the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history. Detroit Resurrected to Bankruptcy and Back. We were talking about the test imposed by Judge Rhodes, whether there was a level of fairness. Was it ultimately a compromise that was fair for the city of Detroit and its citizens?
Well, Judge Rhodes ended up arguing that it was fair, and he says it's based on his conscience, that he can, as a federal bankruptcy judge, decide whether it treats the employees of the city and the retirees of the city and the creditors of the city fairly. And, of course, the residents, because ultimately Detroit's residents are the people who had been neglected for so many years by the political leaders of the city and the state. And they're the ones who've been left in the neighborhoods, waiting for someone to do something about this financial crisis and humanitarian crisis. And I think what Judge Rhodes said is that the outcome, which did involve some sacrifices from the retirees and from the creditors, was fair because it had to put the city first. It had to actually carve out money to spend on demolishing abandoned homes, which is one of the things that this does. And it also gives them money to hire new police officers, to give raises to firefighters who took cuts in previous years, and to start purchasing buses to get people moving in the city because the bus system has been broken for so long. Very basic services that I think Americans have come to expect and they deserve. That's what they're now investing in Detroit.
We talked about the culprits and maybe the heroes. It's really tough to find heroes in this story because even somebody who seems to be doing good work, for example, a Kevin Orr, the emergency director, he was not an elected official. There was a good deal of controversy there. We probably identified Kwame Kilpatrick as one of the worst culprits, although there were many. Identify the hero in this story.
No, I think it's a worthy point because I often think that we make a mistake when we describe someone as a hero or as a villain because so often there's a gray area and no one is purely heroic or purely villainous, And during the case in Detroit, many people would have described the Wall Street creditors as the villains and the retirees or the people as the heroes. But I think the reality is that everyone had reasons for doing what they did. The creditors had a reason for pursuing the liquidation of the art museum, and ultimately it was saved. And whether you agree that they should have taken that stance or not, I think depends on your perspective. But you have to ask yourself, if I was in that situation where my claims were at stake, would I have acted similarly? And so I think there's gray area. Whether they're heroes or not, it's I don't know if I'd say anyone was a hero, but I'd say that there were people who tried to do the right thing. And ultimately, the right thing was to put the people of Detroit before the creditors of Detroit and before the retiree costs, because that combination is what dragged the city down for so long. And now the city has a surplus, and they're back on their feet.
Well, back on their feet. It's not the Detroit of 80 years ago.
True.
But,
and I think that's right. I think that the city's recovery will be a long time coming, and no one should expect it to get back to that. But ultimately, they do have a chance now to start putting the people first and addressing crime and some of these chronic issues.
And is it really resurrected? Are there things going on that you could say, yeah, that's coming back, and maybe I would even consider moving my family there?
I titled the book Detroit Resurrected because I think it implies that the city has a second chance at life, and that's what it is. I don't necessarily say the city was saved or revived or anything like that. I mean, ultimately, they have a second chance to get things right, and what they do with it now is up to them and the political leaders who are elected, because the elected officials are back in control of Detroit.
Yeah.
And I'm optimistic but cautious because the school system has trouble. There are many other chronic issues in Detroit.
But getting there.
Long term, I am optimistic, yeah.
Yeah, I tell you what, if you wondered about what happened in Detroit, this is the book that'll tell you. Detroit Resurrected to Bankruptcy and Back by Nathan Bomey. Detroit Resurrected. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing the story.
Great to be on. Appreciate it so much.